Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that Thanksgiving wasn't always celebrated on the fourth Thursday of November. In fact, there were several years in the 30s and 40s when we just couldn't pin down a date. Before 1939, Thanksgiving was simply celebrated on the last Thursday of November. The thing is, November sometimes has 4 weeks, and other years it stretches into five, as it does this 2017th year. In 1863, amid the brutality of battle that was ripping apart the country, President Abraham Lincoln issued a proclamation. He declared that every year, on the last Thursday of November, they would have a day of thanksgiving and praise. The last Thursday was actually significant because this was the day that George Washington declared the very first National Thanksgiving in 1789. And such was life for the next 76 years. But when the Great Depression came along and shook the foundation of American life, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt decided to mix things up. In 1939, the last Thursday of November fell on the last day of the month, and FDR was concerned that a shortened Christmas shopping season would dampen the already slow economic recovery. So in August of 1939, Roosevelt issued another presidential proclamation, moving Thanksgiving to the second-to-last Thursday of November, which threw just about everyone off. The main problem was that this proclamation was basically last minute. The calendars were long printed, and football teams had already scheduled their big games for what should have been Thanksgiving, but was now just an ordinary weekday. One of FDR's Republican rivals in Colorado was actually so angry about this move that he compared the president's action to the omnipotence of Hitler. States, for their parts, were divided on the change. 22 states moved their Thanksgiving to the second to last Thursday, 23 states stuck to the 70-year tradition, and at least two states actually observed both Thanksgiving holidays. But Roosevelt wasn't deterred, and he stuck with the change for the 1940 calendar year. But by 1941, FDR admitted his mistake and told the American public that the following year the nation would revert back to the traditional date, the last Thursday in November. But considering how much confusion FDR's changeup had caused, Congress decided to act and set a fixed date for the holiday once and for all. So in the fall of 1941, the House and Senate passed a resolution establishing the holiday as the fourth Thursday of the month. And this took into account those pesky years when November was five Thursdays. President Roosevelt signed the resolution on December 26, 1941, and the rest was history. This week I learned that the tradition of breaking the wishbone is thousands of years old. Perhaps you've done this at the end of your poultry meal. Once the bird is picked clean, two people, usually the youngest of the group, each grab a hold of one side of that bell-shaped wishbone. Each makes a wish and pulls. The one who manages to yank the center gets their wish granted, or so the old wives' tale tells. Technically, a bird's wishbone is called the furcula, which, fun fact, means little fork in Latin. It's formed by the fusion of two clavicles. Clavicles are actually not unique to birds. Some dinosaurs also have them. And of course, we also have a version of them. Ours are the unfused kind, and we call them collarbones. Now, as far as that bone snapping tradition goes, it is not actually an American one. We got it from the English. The English actually got it from the Romans, and the Romans didn't invent it either. That honor goes to an ancient Italian civilization called the Etruscans. According to mentalfloss.com, Etruscans believed that birds were oracles that could predict the future. To prove this, Etruscans would perform a ritual known as rooster divination. They would draw a circle on the ground and divide it into wedges representing the different letters of the alphabet. They would then toss some food around the outside of the circle and place the chicken at its center. As the bird ate the food, scribes would note the sequence of letters that the hen had picked at. Those letters were then turned over to a local priest who would divine the future out of this jumbled message. When a chicken was killed and eaten, the wishbone was preserved and dried so that people still had access to the oracle's powers. As the bone dried in the sun, people would be able to pass by and pick it up and make wishes upon it, hence the nickname, the wishbone. One thing that historians aren't quite sure about is why it was the furcula bone that was signaled out as special, but nonetheless, it persisted. And when the Romans romped through Europe, they adopted some of the Etruscans' traditions, including making wishes on the furcula. But it was the Romans who evolved the custom into breaking the bone to solidify the wish. And then it was the English who picked up on the custom next, plucking it from the Romans who traipsed through their land as well. And when the English settlers landed in the New World, the wishbone came with them. Only on this new land, pilgrims had not only chickens to wish from, but also their bigger cousin, the turkey. Which is how the wishbone came to be a time-honored cap to the big Thanksgiving Day meal. This week I learned that your gluten sensitivity may have nothing to do with gluten. An entire industry has popped up around gluten sensitivity. Grocery stores, online markets, and even bodegas sell pretty much any goodie under the sun, like flour, pasta, cookies, all without gluten. But first, there's a few things to understand about this sensitivity. For one, it's quite different from celiac disease. Celiac disease is an inherited autoimmune disorder that is very much affected by gluten. When someone with celiac disease eats gluten, a protein found in wheat, rye, and barley, their immune system freaks out and attacks their small intestine. And this inhibits the absorption of nutrients into the body and makes you feel really crummy. Symptoms range from abdominal bloating to pain to fatigue and honestly much, much worse. Now, people who are sensitive to gluten can also experience these celiac disease symptoms, but they do not have the autoimmune disorder. Bread and other gluten-filled yummy things make them feel crappy and sluggish and often worse. But the thing is, science has never really confirmed that gluten is to blame. It was causational. People stopped eating gluten products and they felt better. But a new study may have zeroed in on the real source of the stomach pain. Fructan, a type of sugar chain that stores carbohydrates. So for this study, researchers recruited 59 people who were on a strict gluten-free diet, but who did not have celiac disease. The participants were given 7-day supplies of specially formatted muesli bars. One type had gluten, another had fructan, and a third had neither. All of them tasted exactly alike. You couldn't tell what you were eating. The volunteers were then divided into 3 groups, and each group had to eat one type of bar for 7 days and record any sort of irritable bowel symptoms they had. They had a week break in between and they moved on to the next bar until they finished the cycle. At the end of the experiment, researchers found that the gluten bar had no effect on the volunteers' health. But the fructan bar triggered 15% more bloating and a 13% increase in overall gastrointestinal symptoms. And this probably explains why people who go gluten-free don't make a full recovery. Fructan is found in a lot of gluten products like wheat, barley, and rye, but fructan is also found in other things like onions, garlic, chickpeas, cabbage, and artichokes. You see, fructans are part of a food group known as FODMAP, F-O-D-M-A-P, And these are a collection of short sugar chains that are notoriously difficult to digest. That's because they draw in water and are fermented in the large intestine by gas-producing bacteria. This causes the gut to stretch uncomfortably. So while a low-fructan diet would close you off to more food options, it does open up a range of food that was previously off-limits, like soy sauce and sourdough. This week I learned that country names aren't at all original. Around the world, there are 195 independent states. Those are the ones recognized by the United States. Each of those nations, naturally, has a name. And according to some extensive research conducted by Quartz, they are either a tribal name, a feature of the island, a directional description of the country, or the name of an important person. And by person, I mean man, because there is literally one country in this whole world named after a woman. But I'll get to that in a moment. Let's dig into some of the details. So countries named after tribes, kingdoms, or ethnic groups comprise more than a third of the world's countries, by far the largest group. There's a big cluster in Europe. So France, for example, is named after the Franks. Italy was named after the Vitali tribe, and Switzerland was named after the Swazi people. South Korea was named after Han tribes of the 2nd century BC, but not all names are so ancient. In 1957, the Gold Coast gained independence from the British and was renamed Ghana after the 13th century empire. Quartz came across some more endearing examples of countries named after people. Burkina Faso, for example, named in 1984, means land of honest men or land of incorruptible people. About a quarter of the world's countries fit into the second category, countries named after some special quality of the land. Algeria, for example, is named after a collection of islands that once made up the bay of its capital. Algiers, the name of its capital, means the islands. Montenegro is named after a mountain that's there. Sierra Leone was likely named Lion Mountains by the Portuguese, but that's not a reference to actual lions. Instead, it's a reference likely to the roaring sound of thunder known to pass through the hilly region. Iceland is kind of interesting. If you've ever been there, you'll know that it's not as icy as its name suggests. And according to the research, the Norse settlers who first arrived on the island in the 9th century adopted the name to deter visitors from coming to the actually surprisingly temperate northern locale. About 25 countries fall into the third category, directional location, which, as you might imagine, is perhaps the least imaginative. Norway, for example, just means northern way, and Australia just means southern. And that leads us to the last category, countries named after man. Another 25 countries falls into this category. The Philippines, for example, are named after Spain's 16th century King Philip II. Bolivia is named after the Venezuelan revolutionary Simon Bolivar. The good old US of A was named after the Italian explorer Amerigo Vespucci. He was credited with figuring out that the continent the Europeans happened across in the late 1400s was not, in fact, India. Christopher Columbus named a whopping 8 countries. His inspiration was often biblical. The country Dominica, for example, is named for Sunday, the day Columbus reached the island. Trinidad was named for the Holy Trinity. And San Salvador, an island district in the Bahamas, was named after the Holy Savior. If that weren't enough, Christopher Columbus obviously was also given the honor of having a country named after him, Colombia. There is only one country, one, in all of the nearly 200 this world has to offer that was named after a woman. That is Saint Lucia, an island in the Caribbean. Saint Lucia was first settled by indigenous peoples of South America and the Caribbean who actually feuded over the island. But naturally, it would take European settlers to give the island nation a name. French pirates reportedly shipwrecked on the island in 1502, and so France laid claim to it, naming it after St. Lucia of Syracuse, a young Christian martyr of the early 4th century. And what was Dear Lucy's story? Well, not too much is known about her. Like many female Christian martyrs of her era, she pledged herself a virgin to God. Instead of being married, she wanted to give her dowry to the poor, but her mother promised her to a suitor instead. When Lucy convinced her mother to let her spread the wealth they had anyway, the suitor betrayed her to the governor of Syracuse, who sentenced her to, of all things, being defiled in a brothel. Legend has it that Lucy would not budge when she was ordered away. Not even oxen could pull her from her spot, so guards tried to burn her right there, but the wood wouldn't catch. Eventually, they plunged a sword into her, and that was the end of Lucy. So it seems only fitting that at the very least, this woman gets an island in her name. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you'd like to hear more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can head on over to theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainer series. And if you've come across any scientific tidbits, fascinating studies, or historical revelations that you'd like to share, email me. You can reach me at podcasts@theweek.com. And until next week, I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.